We are rolling. Rolling and rocking. Rocking and or rolling. Rockling.
We're broccoli? We're broccoli?
Broccolini. All right.
What's broccolini? Is it just small broccoli?
I think it's longer.
Oh.
Like, it's like broccoli is like short and stout.
Is it of a teapot?
Broccolini is like, it looks like asparagus with a broccoli top.
Oh, okay.
From memory.
Fair enough. Now we've got that out of the way.
Yes. Let's get back to the actual episode. Welcome to Dead House. I'm Dylan.
And I'm Nathan.
And today...
Did that even pick up?
I'm sure it did. Today is essentially our 1 year anniversary. I mean, it's the 52nd episode. So technically, I guess 53rd is...
We've been dating for longer than 1 year. Yeah, 52 weeks, right?
Yeah. Well, I think from memory... Because of like how the streaming services work, when you upload a podcast for the first time and it needs to like recognize who it belongs to and all that jazz, episode one, I think, dropped like a day before episode two. Given there's 52 weeks in a year, this is essentially rounding out 1 year.
This is the 1 year anniversary podcast.
Yeah. And it's kind of fitting, really, like the film that we're doing. And I've realized this is also now going to coincide with the annual Academy Awards every year.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was this week.
That was this week, okay.
Yeah, the 96th Academy Awards.
Wow, when are they going to stop?
God.
I saw maybe one thing that I liked.
Mm. I've noted the...
And then I realized I didn't like it because it wasn't real.
Yeah, I don't know. It's very rare that horror or even like thriller will permeate the Academy Awards.
Oh, yeah. Did anything make it in this year?
Not horror per se, but I've got a few old mentions. So,
like Godzilla, the Japanese one.
Yeah. Godzilla Minus One.
Yeah.
Won the award for best visual effects.
I believe it. Which I've not seen it, but it's a Godzilla.
I've not seen it, but I'm keen because I've heard it's arguably one of the best in that kind of franchise.
I'll be honest with you. It's not hard to be the best in that franchise.
Yeah, well, when you're going from like that, 90s Matthew Broderick one, which I liked growing up, saw it again when I was older, and I was like, well, that's rough.
Yep. It's barely a Godzilla movie.
Yeah. But we did have Emma Stone for Best Actress in Poor Things.
Oh, hell yeah. That's
which,
right.
Which you saw, right? At New Farm with Alex. Yeah.
And I mean, I wouldn't call that horror by any means, by any stretch of the imagination. It's definitely artsy.
Yeah.
But it's not horror.
Yeah. I mean, I still respect a film that's not independent, but... Well, I don't know if it is independent, but like an artsy film as opposed to one of the Hollywood blockbusters making the cut.
Yeah, although speaking of her, she was announced to be in the next Ari Aster movie.
Mm, so you were just talking about that.
And I don't know if that is going to be horror. Like, apparently it's going to be some sort of a Western movie, which made me think, have we had like a Western horror movie? Like Nope is kind of like current day Western-ish, but like an olden day, like rootin' tootin' spaghetti Western horror movie. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Two come to mind, one being From Dusk Till Dawn, which is like Tarantino and George Clooney as vampires in the West.
But I don't know if they're, like, when I say Western, I mean like cowboys.
Yeah. In that regard, Bone Tomahawk
with
Kurt Russell. I've not seen it, but I've heard that's kind of like cannibalistic Indians.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, I mean, an Ari Aster approach would be cool.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know if it will be horror.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it'll definitely be artsy. That's for sure. And someone's head will get smashed.
And there'll be naked old people.
Mm-hmm,
but, of course, Oppenheimer cleaned up, taking Best Picture in the process, which kind of weirdly ties in with today's episode by 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah, look, I'm excited to see how you're connecting that.
I'll come back to that. Before we get into the pod, though, what have you been up to this week?
This week, not too much. I haven't really watched anything horror-related. Just been reading You still. I'm almost finished.
Oh, yeah, nice.
But today, lovely old Sunday, I went for a beach day with Alex.
Good move.
And I say lovely. It was very grey and like drizzly and raining.
Yeah.
But we went because we wanted to do like a scouting trip because we're going to go camping there soon. And we wanted to sort of suss out the campsites and pick which one we wanted to stay at. So we got like a list. And man, my car got dirty because of all the fucking rain.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to go to the markets because I don't think I've been at all this year. And I used to go fortnightly. So I like penned it into my diary like a week ago. I was like, yep, I've got a 4-day weekend. I'm finally going back to the markets. Wake up and it's drizzly.
You could have still gone.
Yeah, but I chose to stay in and watch a movie instead. So maybe next weekend. I went to a new heavy festival called New Bloom Fest.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of like all emo... pop punk kind of stuff. And it was headlined by Movements, one of my favorite bands.
That's up your alley.
And Citizen, who I've never seen live before, but they have like a quintessential emo record, their debut album, which I stayed for a few tracks from that and then left because I wanted to beat the crowd getting out of the car park. And they've now got like five albums. I'm only really familiar with the first one.
Right. But you, yeah, really, cool. You really just went for Movements.
Yeah, it was Movements with the big one. They also had like some cool locals, like Eat Your Heart Out and Bad Neighbor, which was sick. But yeah, I'm hoping it becomes a recurring thing because they had like stalls as well with like, they had a representative from a local label bring crates with like vinyl in it. They had merch. They had a jewelry stall, which was cool.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I bumped into some cool people in the scene. So yeah, it was very nice. It was a good time.
Sounds right up your alley. Sounds like hell to me.
So, oh yeah, you know what? Fucking $16 for a can of CC and Dry.
That is fucked.
That's grim.
That's no good at all.
I think last time I was there, it was like 12 because I had this game with Sean. It's like when we go to shows at different venues, it's like, oh, how much do you reckon the fucking CC and Dry is here? Because that's like our go-to.
Yeah.
And I think the best I've paid is maybe like 11. Which even then,
a single can of like 375 mil of CC and Dry.
Yeah.
That's disgusting.
Yeah. But so how Oppenheimer kind of ties into this movie is today we are talking about A Quiet Place from 2018. And when I said earlier that this is kind of fitting for our 52nd episode to round out a year at this pod is that Quiet Place was one of the films in my top five.
It is,
which we did in episode two. And how it relates to Oppenheimer is the star of that film, Cillian Murphy,
I've just realized,
was one of the characters in A Quiet Place Part 2.
Dose.
So, yeah, take that with a grain of salt.
Okay, I'll give you that. Is this the last movie from your top? Oh, no, we haven't done Signs.
We haven't done Signs, and we haven't done The Lighthouse from your top five.
That's right, yeah. Okay.
Which I barely consider horror, but yeah. I did enjoy it, so I'm willing to do it.
It's existential, kind of metaphysical horror, if that makes sense,
it's,
I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely psychological. Yeah, it's psychological, but is it thriller? I don't know. It's psychological.
I don't know. Who knows what it is?
Cosmic horror. We'll get into it when we do an episode on it.
But A Quiet Place is definitely, I'd say, more horror.
Mm, yeah, for sure.
Which is funny, and it kind of makes sense why it, I don't know, maybe works so well in that it's a horror, but it is like a heavy drama, like a family drama.
Yeah.
And I read that John Krasinski, who's obviously the main star and director and like co-writer, is not like a big horror fan. And so he didn't want to do a horror movie.
Yeah.
But then he like actually read the script and got the pitch for it. And he's like, oh, okay, I'm going to make it then.
Yeah.
And so it's like if he's coming at it in his point of view from a non-horror, then that gives it like so much more to work with and fleshes it out. And then other people just add in the horror.
Well, from memory, he was given the script from the writers or from the studio to consider the role of the father.
Oh, yeah.
And then he was talking to people about his ideas for it. And he had like developed the story so much further in his own mind than what was on the paper. They're like, dude, you've got to direct this film.
It's that easy.
Yeah, which is kind of cool. Should we do the pitch?
Go ahead, pitch it.
How we would pitch this to people who have not seen it in one sentence. Grieving family rebuilds in a world terrorized by blind creatures with acute hearing.
Yes, there you go.
Unusual.
Pretty original. I mean, it kind of takes the like end of the world apocalypse style, but just adds in a new monster and focuses more on the family side of it.
Yeah, it's funny you sort of saying before about how it's more so a family drama in a horror setting, which are some of my favorite horrors, to be honest, because it just has so much more substance to the story that way. And I found a lot of similarities to Signs.
I could see it. It's alien invasion, family focused, on a fucking corn farm.
The color red.
The color red, which I only really noticed in the light bulbs. I'm guessing it showed up more.
I'll dive into those parallels a bit later in the episode. But yeah, I just found that interesting from like a personal reflective position. But the film's really about the family, like the aliens, and the fact that they need to sort of be super quiet to survive is just like the world. And I just find that naturally very interesting.
I think that's also probably the reason they decided to like have the majority of the movie set, 400 and something days after the invasion. Like you don't have to focus on what's happening at the start of the invasion, because it doesn't matter. You know, it's what's this family's life like trying to rebuild a year later.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I enjoy about post-apocalyptic horror films, or just, you know, films that are set after a worldwide disaster like that, is because it'd be easy to make like an action film where you're there from day one and you're seeing the people get out of the city and everything's new and they're learning everything. But it's more investive when it's like lived in and which the events have already taken place.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons I'm not exactly too keen on the upcoming like sequel / prequel to this movie. Like,
yeah.
Place day one. It's like, well, we've seen a snippet of day one in the sequel.
Yeah.
And like, I'm not interested in the day one.
Mm.
But on the same token, if they can make an interesting story with interesting characters and it just happens to take place in day one,
yeah,
and they focus on that instead of focusing on like the aliens coming in the army fighting them, you know, it could still be good.
Yeah, I enjoyed part two very much. In fact, it's one of my favorite horror sequels. And I do like that you get a glimpse of day one, particularly because it's shot well.
Mm.
It sets it up similar to The Blob, which I think we mentioned in that episode.
Yeah.
But also...
adds in more John Krasinski, which is good.
Yeah, more Krasinski. A lot of one-shot takes in action sequences. A lot of practical effects. It has a lot going for it. It expands the lore and the world a bit. But a lot of criticism I've seen online is that it's essentially the first film again.
Yeah, it's the first film.
Same beats.
But in a different location with one different character, really.
Yeah. So I get people's qualms with it.
They're not necessarily my qualms with it. I'm not a huge fan of it. I'm fine with it.
Mm.
It's not because it's like too similar to the first one. It's just because it just starts doing things that I feel like aren't needed. Like, you don't need to show that. Like,
okay.
The whole island with the people that are living there and they're carefree because they think they're safe. And,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I've just seen that too many times before.
Yeah, I do like that it ups the stakes.
Somewhat predictable, maybe.
Okay. But what is, confusing about this third sequel, the second sequel, part three or whatever, called Day One, which isn't...
So it's number three, which is a prequel, which is called Day One.
Yeah. It seems unnecessary because they've already shown a flashback of the event first taking place, except it's from a different city or a different perspective. Mm. And it's not written or directed by Krasinski, so there's not a lot going for it that interests me.
That's what I'm worried of. I'm kind of worried that it is just a cash grab. Because something I didn't realize, but the movie is like produced by Platinum Dunes.
Yeah,
is Michael Bay's film company, essentially.
Yeah.
And they're kind of known for putting out some... like blatant cash grabs, but just make a movie, make it, you know, big and loud, and you know, put some star power in it, and then reek in the money.
Yeah, very different kind of film for that label for sure. So I guess we'll go into some background. Like you said, directed by John Krasinski, weirdly known for like The Office, and
which I've not even seen, and I refuse to. So, but I do like John Krasinski because of mainly this movie.
He's a lovable guy. I gotta respect him.
Yeah, he seems very wholesome. He's got that like dad energy.
Yeah, yeah. And it was co-written by Krasinski as well as Brian Woods and Scott Beck, who submitted the script to Paramount, who weirdly enough wanted it to be set in the Cloverfield universe.
I did read that. And honestly, I could kind of see it.
I can see it with the creature design.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
Creature design and...
Maybe in comparison to like 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah, well, I think that's what they were sort of going for. But like, would they still have it be the creatures that are blind and super good hearing? Or would they try and just lean into like the actual Cloverfield monsters? I don't know.
Not sure.
But I am glad they didn't do that because...
Yes.
Yeah, it would have had the Cloverfield name attached to it, and then it would have come with all sort of like preconceived notions and...
Mm.
I don't know. It wouldn't have been a fair representation.
Yeah, I feel like they would have done that as a marketing move, but ironically it would have harmed it. So it definitely served better being a standalone film. Also, it was starring Krasinski, so... And I think he helped with like one of the first few cuts of editing as well. So this man was invested in this project.
And I think he did some of the motion capture for the monsters.
He did, yeah.
This man did everything on this movie.
He had his finger in all the pies. So it stars Krasinski, his wife, Emily Blunt, Millicent Simmons as the daughter, and Noah Jupe as the son. And what I think makes the family interaction so effective in this film is you've got a married couple and a deaf girl in those actual roles. Mm-hmm. So it's inherently got this level of authenticity to it.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a really bold move. And I think Krasinski, I've seen in interviews, was like super nervous for Emily to like read the script or hear his opinion on it and that kind of thing. Because it's like, man, we're married and we live together. How are we going to go working together?
yeah, they pull it off.
Yeah, they did.
Didn't end in a divorce.
Did a brilliant job. And it was made on a budget of $17 million and went on to make $340.9 million. So
that's what you call successful. What you call successful.
Yeah, it worked.
And critically loved as well. Like, it got a very good like Rotten Tomatoes score.
Mm.
From everything I heard from everyone I was talking to, they loved it.
As far as like monster movies go, particularly like surrounding an alien invasion, that typically will come with like some sort of preconception that it's going to be a B movie or an action movie.
Yep.
For it to be as revered as it is, particularly this late in horror history as well, I thought was quite impressive.
Yes. I don't think it's all down to the emotion of it.
For sure.
It doesn't even necessarily go for like scares. There's definitely moments in it that are like, not even frightening, but like tense. There are very tense moments.
Yeah.
But
I love a good suspense horror.
Yeah. And there's a couple of moments too where I was like, well, this is very alien-like, but like the movie Alien.
Yeah, I'll be honest. There were more moments in this film that I felt choked up than scared.
Yeah, okay.
And power to the approach of the technique and everything. It was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Sound Editing. Did not win, but deserves to be nominated. And I did read that on set, a lot of the crew were trying to be dead silent. So when they recorded like the ambience and the foley for the film, they could enhance it. In post. So, you know, if you step on something and a twig breaks, or if you grab a bag of something and it crinkles, like everything makes you paranoid and sit on the edge of the seat.
Yeah.
And like you said, Krasinski played a lot of the creatures in a motion capture suit, which is badass. That'll be so funny to watch in test screenings.
Oh, yeah.
Either nothing there or just Krasinski in a blue suit. And it only had around 25 lines of dialogue.
Which that is not many.
I think, yeah, is more power to how effective spoken, the body language
spoke,
is.
Like loudly spoken dialogue, I'm guessing.
I think it's dialogue in general.
Well, a lot of the times when they're doing sign language, they sort of like mouth the words. I'd call that dialogue still.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah. 25 lines of spoken dialogue, yeah. We'll say then. And yeah, like I said, a lot of it is with ASL, which the cast learned also would have helped to communicate with Millicent, who played the daughter, but they had an ASL instructor on set at all times to kind of hold him accountable. And I mentioned before that Krasinski had a hand in the editing as well. He even considered making the entire film silent after he saw the first cut, which would have been a very bold move in this day and age, particularly with people who have a gripe with subtitles.
Yeah, that would be very strange. Because I also read that he originally didn't even want subtitles for the sign language. Well, I don't know if it was him, but the people making the movie didn't want subtitles.
Yeah.
And the only reason they end up putting it in is because of the conversation between the daughter and John when he like gives her the earring. The earpiece. And it's like, if you don't have sign language, then... Oh, if you don't have subtitles, that's like a hard conversation to follow.
Mm.
But everything else in the movie would be fine.
I think it would have been interesting to see it, maybe not silent, but... Oh, well, it could have been silent with, like, an emotive score. Like, if it still had the music to it. Or even if it was just, like, that dull, kind of muted ambience, like when you're seeing things from the daughter's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And just have sort of her perspective throughout the entire film, that could have worked. But, yeah, it would have been very experimental and not super accessible if you were going for kind of, like, box office success.
Yeah. And I mean, I still would have liked it.
Yeah, I think it would have been interesting, which they do explore a bit more in part two because the daughter kind of becomes the main character.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this is about the first one. I got to stop bringing up part two. I just love it so much. So I said before, it's kind of a family drama in a horror setting. And the creatures, which are essentially aliens, I like that they're referred to in like newspaper clippings as death angels or angels of death.
I'll be honest, I didn't even catch that.
Yeah, and that's also how you learn that it's kind of set in rural New York, because they've got like these newspaper clippings of day one and when they're learning about the creatures and how many have been killed and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, a lot of the like lore and behind the scenes of how it happened is just in the background on newspaper clippings. And you think an over the top reference is when they walk out of the like the drugstore and there's one newspaper like blowing in the wind and it says like sound is the key or something.
Yeah.
It's pretty much saying that they hunt sound.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, okay, you need that one blowing in the wind for the audience members that aren't paying attention to everything.
Mm.
But then like later in the movie, you just sort of see newspapers where it's, yeah, multiple like landing sites, stuff like that.
Yeah. But I do like that you only get that. Like they never, there's no talk between characters about how it happened or what they think it is.
Mm.
Like
which,
it's...
Which I'm good because it's something that a lot of B-grade movies suffer from, especially... Shyamalan. It's when a bunch of characters are stuck in a position and they have the scene where the characters are trying to figure out what it is between themselves.
Mm.
I don't know why I don't like it. It always just seems so disingenuous.
Yeah.
Like they're throwing out guesses like, oh, maybe it's this. No, this can't be that. It's this. Mm. I don't know. I always hate those scenes.
Well, I'll be honest. It's a bit of a weird example, but one of my favorite things about Shaun of the Dead is you never find out how the zombies come to be.
Yeah. And honestly...
Whereas in a lot of zombie movies, like that's... Like, core to the first act is, like, why are people up walking around killing people?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's better. Like, because, like, at the end of the day, you know, who cares what caused it? That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is, you know, this family or is Sean getting drunk or hungover? I don't know.
You're immersed in this world with them. The details don't matter. It's just survival.
Yeah.
And, the alien design was inspired by prehistoric fish and their functionalities were taken from bats, which, you know, with like the sonic radar kind of clicking they do makes sense, I guess.
The old echolocation?
Yeah, that's the word. But I say sonic location or some shit.
Yeah, sonic something.
Sonic radar.
What is a sonic radar?
Well, I guess so.
Same thing.
And I really like that the first act spends a lot of time letting the viewers see... how they've adapted their lifestyle to this situation.
Mm-hmm.
Like you get all the signing when they communicate, which obviously they're just fortunate to have had a deaf daughter. So they're already like better prepared than most people to live in that world. The soundproofing of the house where they've got like mattresses and pillows in the walls everywhere. And they've created these paths through town of sand. So they don't have to walk on like crunchy leaf litter and, and all that kind of thing. So... they're already kind of, they were kind of set up for this world beforehand. Even like the solar panels, I guess. The fact that they still have power to a degree.
Yeah, true.
So I really liked that aspect of it. Like you said, the opening sequence is kind of a flashback of day 89.
Mm.
And I love that this opening sequence has so much intrigue. It's like 10 minutes before you get the A Quiet Place title card.
Yep.
Which is sick, by the way, that like sprinkling of sand. Mm-hmm. Kind of reminded me of the spore in like menus of The Last of Us game.
I mean, I've never played that, so I'm not sure.
Anyway, so much intrigue to it because it's like all these characters being extremely careful. They're so quiet. They're in this desolate town. They're walking on their tiptoes. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't know why, you don't know what's happened, you don't know where they are at this point. And
everything's being pillaged from the shops except the packet of chips. Like, what could have possibly happened that could get people off chips?
Yeah, that's smart. And I also liked it when the young boy finds the toy rocket and he, like, knocks off the shelf and the daughter catches it. Everyone's, like, looking around with bated breath. And then, you know, the father removes the batteries. And the daughter gives him the toy without him to, you know, play with. They're treating it like a bomb.
Yeah.
Like they're very careful with this. And I find that so fascinating. I remember seeing it for the first time. I was like, what is in this fucking rocket? And it's just sound. Mm-hmm. They were just deathly afraid of making any kind of sound. Something that I guess we'll go into now is like a big theme of this film is sort of parents protecting their children to the best of their ability before they inevitably can't. Because kids will grow up, enter the world on their own, get hurt, parents will die, all that kind of thing. And that's kind of like the underlying theme of this film, despite being set in an alien invasion. And I like that the daughter is sort of harboring this guilt for her younger brother's death.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll just straight out say it. At the end of the opening sequence... The kid puts the batteries in the rocket when they're walking home. It lights up, flashes, makes sound, and he gets killed by an alien before the father can get to him, right?
Yes.
the daughter handed him the rocket, and you know, when the rest of the film takes place from like day 472 or 473, whatever it is, there's this tension between her and the family, or at least her and the father, where she kind of blames herself for his death. And you even get a scene later where the mother is like, oh, my hands were free, I could have carried him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So like a few different family members, right, feel responsible. But someone who never at least communicates that guilt is the father, but he's the one who left the batteries. He removed the batteries from the rocket, sat them both on the table, and walked out. So the little kid just grabs the batteries and puts them in.
Yeah, but I think he's got to be the least to blame, surely.
I mean,
well, actually, the little brother is the least to blame. But to me, yeah, okay, I see where you're coming from, but it is more the sister to blame than the father. Not that she's to blame either. It's an unfortunate accident that it happened.
Yeah.
Like, it's a kid doing something stupid because he's a kid and he doesn't really know better.
Mm.
It's the daughter because she, in a way, kind of sort of teaches the little brother that it's okay to disobey the dad and here's a toy. And he sees that and he doesn't know the difference between, oh, well, she grabbed the toy. What's the difference between that and the batteries? It's fine.
Yeah. That kind of becomes a trait of hers as well throughout the film, is like not doing what she's told.
Yeah. She's a strong, independent woman.
She's rebellious. And yeah, and I guess it ties in with that theme as well. It's like kids are going to make mistakes. As much as a parent can tell them, don't do this, don't do that, and give them, you know, life advice, they're not going to learn until they do it themselves. Yeah, right?
And it's just unfortunate that the movie takes place in a time and location that if you do make those mistakes, that's it. You don't make another one.
Yeah, that's right. So one of my favorite things in the first act, like I said, is it lets the audience live in this world with the characters and experience this post-apocalyptic environment. And the way it does that is it shows their daily rituals.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got like the father scanning the radio frequencies, trying to make contact. You've got him setting the rooftop fires where they kind of like check in with neighbors by lighting this bonfire every night. The farming, the homeschooling, you know, the now pregnant mother like taking her blood pressure, like all this kind of thing. And obviously something that raises the stakes, establishes the stakes, is that she is now pregnant again. So there's another little one on the way that, you know, is going to cause problems later in the film. And you've got this really reliable father teaching this reluctant son who's afraid and really hesitant to kind of learn how to hunt and all these practical things that are like survival techniques, right, that you need in this situation. And while the daughter is the one that, you know, seems older and is very keen to sort of be hands-on with him and learn all that stuff and assume that role, there's still that kind of tension where, you know, the father might not believe she's ready, or she believes that the father still has a grudge against her and blames her for the death of their young brother. But I like when they go out hunting and they go to this river nearby, and son kind of freaks out when the fish is, you know, flopping around making a racket, but he kind of points out that because of the rushing water, like it's a safe space. The creatures can't hear him.
Is this before or after the scene where he knocks the torch over when they're playing Monopoly? This is after that.
It's probably after, yeah. Yeah.
That, like, I feel like that's an important thing there, where it sets up that any small, you know, sound is bad.
Mm.
And so when the kid freaks out at the river, it's like, well, because we've seen what happens when a small noise happens.
Yeah.
And that it just, yeah.
That's true.
It's sort of, he's John Krasinski like telling his son, but also the audience, like, okay, well, you've seen that, but now if there's a bigger sound, you know, you're a little bit safer.
Yeah, the kids have kind of been conditioned by how careful and strict the father is. Yeah. So when the father's like, look, you can scream from behind a waterfall, the kid's like freaking out.
Yes.
But something that it kind of sets the rules for this universe as to like how much sound is too much, like how loud a noise can be before it attracts them. And, you know, in the opening sequence, like they're tiptoeing on a hard floor, carefully putting like a plastic toy on a bench. Like it's probably the most careful that they are. And then, you know, they're playing Monopoly with like cotton pieces
instead of like the hard metal pieces
on a rug. And the kid like knocks the lantern over and it sets fire to the floor, and I really love the tension in that scene. You know, the father leaps to action, puts it out, and then they're all just silent looking up at the roof.
Yep.
And you get the raccoon jump scare which is a nice icebreaker. But also, I think very few of the jump scares in this film are from the creatures.
I can't really think of any, to be honest, yeah.
I mean, I guess when it shows the raccoons like scampering away, one of the creatures like kills it, and that's a bit of a jump.
That's not even like a jump scare though. That's just something that happens.
It's just ominous.
Yeah.
But what I find interesting is the creatures, they actually like stalk their prey quite slowly, and it's only when they found their target they're like lightning fast.
Yeah.
So I think that could be why. Like a lot of the time there's like this really drawn out scene where a character is hiding from a creature that's in the room. So it's not really a jump scare.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that when they make a noise or, you know, the creature finds the character, that's when, you know, it becomes like an action sequence. So yeah. I thought that was really interesting, having a film that's largely quiet or silent, but few jump scares.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely, it just leans more into the suspense building and the tensity of it.
Mm. And so after we've kind of seen how the characters live, how they've survived, we've established the sort of somewhat dysfunctional relationships between some of them. The stakes are raised again when the mother goes into labor with a newborn. And
while the father and the son are away doing the hunting.
Yeah. Which
I've only seen this movie twice. Once, like, years ago. Not when it came out, but, like, maybe a year afterwards. Yeah. And then I rewatched it last night. And, like, she goes into labor a lot sooner than I remember. It gets kind of right into it. And then, like, half the movie takes place after she goes into labor.
Yeah, I think I've read that people have, like, done the math and paid attention to figure out that the whole film takes place over, like, a month. But it kind of feels like 3 days.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she goes into labor, water breaks, she's freaking out, she's home alone. And then I can't remember what attracts it, but, like, a creature comes to the house, right? And it's stalking the corridors while she's, like, going upstairs into the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's before that point she, like, throws a switch to change these lights that are strewn all over the property to be red, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure they get attracted when she steps on the nail.
Oh, is that what does it?
Yeah, because she steps on the nail and then, like, drops the, like, something glass and it shatters.
Oh, that's what it is.
And then
she
has a, like, there's a bit of a drawn out scene where she's pulling her foot up.
Yeah.
And then that's when the monster is at the top of the stairs.
Yeah, that's right. Because we get Chekhov's nail earlier in the film. And, like, by the way, if you're carrying, like, a potato sack, whatever it was, and it catches on that, and you see a nail pointing straight upwards on a step, I'm hammering that fucker down. Like,
how are you going to hammer it? That'll attract the monsters.
I don't know. Put a rug over it.
get a cup and bend it upside down. I don't know.
Stick an apple on it. It just ups the ante. You're in a world, you've got to be silent or you're attracted creature. You've just gone into labor, so you know you could be due for like hours of intense pain that's going to be hard to get through without making a peep.
Yep.
And then you step on a fucking nail. Oh, man. Made me cringe the first time I saw this in the cinema.
Yeah. And I could only imagine being like, well, I couldn't imagine, like being a woman who has given birth watching the movie. Because obviously they know they've been through it. They know what it's like. And then they'd probably think, wow, trying to have to be silent. Like you'd think back to when you gave birth and it's like, oh shit.
Mm.
No, I couldn't have done that.
Yeah. Surely it's one of the worst things you could have to go through. Like that or being tortured, which honestly they're somewhat synonymous and not have to make a sound.
I do like the fact that like, she sort of has this trust that her husband will come home, I guess. Or it's either trust or just she's got no option because she throws the lights on, she goes up to the bathtub and then just has to hold on for as long as she can.
Yeah.
And it's just in the nick of time they threw like the fireworks up and then she can scream. But she didn't know they were coming. She didn't know they were anywhere near.
Yeah.
She was just, all right, they've obviously planned it like to a T. I've done my thing. I just need them to come through now.
Just counting on them seeing those red lights.
Yeah.
Which, again, is another kind of example of how smart they are with their preparation.
Because,
like, they knew she was going to have the kid and they'd need all these things. They have, you know, accounted for every possible bad situation. And, yeah, they've got these sort of systems in place that the family kind of has this understanding of how they can kind of come into action when something goes wrong. And, like you said, the fireworks that the father makes the kids set from the rooftop kind of distracts the alien just as it's about to like enter the bathroom as the mother screams. I like that the fireworks are what save them. And he communicates that to the son through sign by saying rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And in the opening sequence, it was a rocket that got someone killed.
Yeah.
So I like that kind of, I don't know, it like counters itself with the same symbol.
Well, because you even had the scene at the, like, even before he got killed, where the little brother says, like, the rocket is the way for them to survive. I can't remember exactly what happens, but he says,
this is how we can get away.
Yeah, this is how we can get away, and, like, has drawn a rocket.
Yeah.
Which makes sense then even more why he grabbed that toy of, like, right, in his mind, a rocket is the way. He thinks he's going to save his family.
Yeah.
Little fucking idiot. R.I.P.
He needed a boat, not a rocket. And talking about how the family's kind of prepared for this situation, she has the baby. She somehow, by some miracle...
Which you have to... You really have to suspend some amount of disbelief for that. Because, what does she have, like a 5-minute labor? I'm pretty sure it goes for longer than that.
But yeah.
It most of the time goes for longer than that. I'm sure there's instances where it's like instantaneous, but...
Well, I think when she...
It's definitely hand-waving the labor process.
I think when her water breaks... There's like some daylight coming in through the window, and then when she's giving birth, it's night.
But surely they didn't have that many fireworks that it was like one after the other for an hour.
No, I don't think so.
It's a good movie. I'm completely happy to hand wave that side of it. It's fine.
You got to give birth. You got to be silent. You have no epidural, no midwife, and you stepped on a rusty fucking nail.
And it's also not like a clean pregnancy or a clean birth, because there's all that blood, which, I mean, I'm no midwife, but that's not normal.
No.
You know, I'm pretty sure you're not meant to bleed that much.
Yeah. That was rough. And the father comes home, sees all the blood in the bathtub, starts breaking down thinking she's died or the creature's grabbed her, and turns out she's just on the other side of the room. And see their newborn, and they've made this like little box that's like padded out to soundproof it with an oxygen tank and a little mask for the kid. So smart.
Smart, yeah. Would have been smarter not to have a kid, but, you know, that's fine.
Well, yeah.
It's going to repair their relationship. I've heard people use that to sort of tear this movie down. That's not what I'm trying to do. It's just like, okay, I assume they maybe accidentally got pregnant. And then what are you going to do? There's no hospital or anything to go have an abortion.
Yeah.
Even if you try to, shit can go wrong there. I don't know. I feel like people just use that as a way to tear it down.
I think also, like, again, it raises the stakes, but it's like a symbol of the family still having hope.
Yeah.
Like beyond a year of the world coming essentially to an end.
100%. Because there's also like the fact that they are homeschooling the kid in a post-apocalyptic world. Why do you need to learn how to fucking do math and read Shakespeare's, you know, shall I compare thee to a summer's day sonnet?
Yeah.
But yeah, it does. It's a symbol of their hope that it will all get better.
Which is for sure.
Also a bit strange because, like, they're kind of just relying on other people to fix it. Like, they're living their life, they're surviving, just living in hope that it'll get better, but not doing anything to make it better.
Yeah, I agree. And you find the son with the daughter on top of the silo, and he falls in to this silo of corn. He's treading corn.
Yep.
Treading corn in the silo, and the sister jumps in. Now, I wanted to ask you, does she do that to help or to hide?
I took it as her helping, because the kid is like drowning in corn.
Yeah.
But then she goes down and like saves him. She like passes the metal door over to him.
I thought... Did the metal door fall in?
Because the metal door fell in.
Before she jumps in?
Ooh.
Because I was like...
I think so.
I feel like it'd be easier to help the kid when you're not also drowning in corn kernels.
How could you help the kid from the top of the silo?
I don't know. Grab something, drop it down that's long and he can grab it. Rapunzel the dude. Pull him out.
Her hair wasn't that long.
No, not hair, but I don't know. Grab a rope or something.
There's a rope at the top of that silo? There should be. Insane silo man should keep a rope at the top of it.
Yeah. I mean, I just found it an odd choice, but I guess when you're in the heat of the moment, you don't think, you just do.
Yeah. I was fine with it. Maybe she's actually really good at treading corn. She spends her days practicing.
They don't have a pool. It makes too much noise, so they swim in corn.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it just shows like the love between those two. And again, that theme of protection. So I get it. But man, when she goes under, that'd be such an awful way to die.
I was thinking about during the movie, like, how would you die?
Corn filling your mouth.
Yeah, I don't know.
It'd just be suffocation.
I think it would just be... I guess it depends how far you sink. Because I know in real life, people have died like in this exact way by falling in grain silos. And I don't know if it's corn or like a different grain, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if you just sink to the bottom and then it kind of just compresses your lungs like a constrictor, or do you literally breathe in corn, which would be awful.
Yeah, that'd be rough. Also, you have to kind of suspend your disbelief for a little longer when the alien arrives, jumps down there with them. They kind of like pull the metal door over themselves as like a barrier, and it can't get through. It like stabs its claw through or whatever, and then absolutely obliterates the side of the silo after it hears like the cochlear implant like interfering with its ears or whatever.
I'm fine with that because I didn't take it as it was trying to attack them. Like it, because you got it's blind. It can't see. It heard something down there. It's gone down there to maybe investigate. It didn't know it was corn down there. And it's just sort of flailing around, just attacking everything. So it's not like it's trying to get through the door to get them. It's just, there's a sound somewhere around here. Let me just thrash around to try and get it.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's how I took it. Maybe I'm giving it too much leniency.
I think as well, being in a silo though, it'd be quite a reverberant space. So any noise it makes might make it harder to like pinpoint where its target is.
Sure. I don't know.
But yeah, I like when the father comes out again after he's left the mother with the newborn in the basement, the soundproof basement, and he grabs the axe and the creature's like there stalking him, knows he's there, swings at it, gets attacked, and then he's sort of like taken one to the side and he's bleeding out or whatever, gets the kids to run down to the truck, and he signs to the kids, mainly the daughter, his love for them, right? And it's quite a touching scene. And then he just unleashes this primal scream. So he can sacrifice himself for the family.
Yep.
So the creature just leaves them alone, kills him, and the kid just releases the handbrake and they roll back to safety at the house. Now, a couple of things I really enjoy about this scene. While it is obviously the climax of the film, the most emotive point in the film.
Yeah, it's definitely the emotional climax. It's not necessarily like the action climax that comes later when they actually kill one, but definitely the emotional climax.
And what I like about it is it takes a few things that were shown earlier in the film and gives them purpose or reconstitutes them, like or recontextualize, sorry. So I guess earlier in the film when father and the son are out hunting.
Don't forget the Holy Spirit.
Very nice. They see like the old man who's just buried his dead wife.
I assumed he killed his wife there. Is that, am I reading too much into that? Like he killed his wife and then he's committing suicide?
Oh, I thought maybe she died of sickness or was killed by a creature.
Well, because she had blood on her, so it probably wasn't a sickness. But yeah, I guess it's left up to interpretation. But the way I saw it was, he couldn't take it anymore, killed her and committed suicide.
Yeah, okay. Because I was wondering whether it was that or he was just grieving.
No.
Like he was just mourning her and just needed to let out this guttural scream.
Anyone who's lived for over a year, in this world would know that that's not okay. That's suicide right there.
Because he's like trembling like before he screams. But I guess it makes a bit more sense that it'd be the suicidal take. And then when the father does it here at back at the home, it's like for sacrifice for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was nice. But also the fact that the kid knows to release the handbrake earlier in the film when they're showing kind of their daily activities, he's like pretending to drive and he pretends to like put the handbrake down. So I thought that was nice. It came back into play. It's like the nail, like everything in this film exists for a reason because it comes back around in a different context by the end of it, which There's a lot of
foreshadow and payoff.
Yeah, exactly. Everything is an omen. The kids get back in home and they go down and meet their... do you find out it's a boy, right? They say it's a boy.
I think so.
So they meet their little brother for the first time. And I like that the daughter sees the father's workshop for the first time. And she can see like how much effort and energy he was putting into like designing a new, better cochlear implant for a hearing. Because the kids were never allowed down there. And she always took that as like, you know, him not thinking that she's old enough or brave enough or ready. And she, again, sees that he was just trying to protect her, right? Mm-hmm. And also is revealed that he did very much love her and was, you know, doing all he could to help her. So it was just a very nice scene. Then an alien's died. A dude screamed. So it attracts more, or it attracts another, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when she remembers, like, the cochlear implant was kind of interfering with it, and the feedback was, like, harming it in the silo. And she just, like, turns on the radio equipment and slams it into the mic, and it just freaks out. Why do you think that is? Do you think, like, the feedback is just harmful to it in that instance because its hearing is so, like, hypersensitive?
I don't know. I dove a little bit into it, not too much, and whatever I say is probably going to be pulled out of my ass and not backed up by science. But I don't know if it's specifically sound. I think it is, like, an actual feedback of, like, it's got to have a receiver and a speaker and a microphone, whatever. Mm. Put those things together.
Yeah.
And it's not just the fact that it's a loud noise. It is, like, specifically because it only happens when they get close.
Mm.
So it's like they put something out.
Yeah.
That like an echolocation, which is received by the, because it's not a normal cochlear implant. He, like, modified it. He said he put in, like, a speaker and an amplifier.
Mm.
So it goes into the cochlear implant, goes out of the cochlear implant, back to the creature. And it's like when you have two phones next to each other, and it just gets louder and louder. So it only works in combination.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, you just have a white noise machine and scare them away.
Mm.
I'm not a huge fan of it in the movie, to be honest.
Okay. Because that was my understanding as well, like in this, like, final sequence when, you know, she uses the microphone for the radio to do it and it makes it louder. I just didn't understand it at first when, like, one of the creatures are near the daughter earlier in the film and there's no other electrical component, yet it still creates the feedback that, you know, harms it. But yeah. it makes sense now if it's like the echolocation. Mm. It's like putting out a signal that is then amplified. And
yeah, because it's not only just echolocation. I think it does have something to electricity because every time the creatures come close, all the lights flicker.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Which I'm
not sure if you noticed. But yeah, like when the boy has got his flashlight, that flickers before they attack. When they're in the basement, the lights flicker before they attack.
Interesting. So maybe they generate some sort of
that's what I mean. Signal. They generate some sort of like electrical slash sound signal. Which,
yeah, wow.
I don't know if that's backed up by physics, but
yeah,
that's what I'm believing.
Yeah, okay, cool. And
but yeah, I don't know. The reason I don't like it is because that's not what the movie's about. Like the movie has been set up this whole time about the hope and, I don't know, the them living in this world. And it's about the family.
Mm.
Like I don't need to see them then take back and
like
defeat them. I don't need to see a movie where they defeat the monster in this case.
Yeah,
I'm completely happy with just watching them live their life and survive.
Yeah, I like that.
And that's one of my gripes with the second movie is that they take that point and then they continue it. So then widespread and they go on the hunt and they, you know, use a radio tower or some shit.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. It moves away from just a family surviving to let's take back what's ours.
Yeah, which can be, no, it's, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. It's fine. It's just not what I wanted from this particular movie.
Yeah. No, I'm inclined to agree.
I might be the odd one out, though.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess for the purpose of this scene, I do like that they find a way to defeat it. Like, they inhibit it with the feedback, and then they can shoot it. Because what we haven't really touched on until now is that they have, like, armor. Like, bulletproof skin.
Yeah.
And their faces open up. It's like Demogorgon honestly, style.
Gross. I don't know if I've mentioned before, I probably have, but like body shit where stuff opens where it shouldn't is gross to me. Like a fish's gills, gross.
Yeah, I agree.
These cunts' heads, fucking disgusting. I hate it.
Because it's really interesting. It like separates into like 10 different parts.
Yeah.
So it can be like a dish and like receptive of audio around it. And
it's gross.
When it shows like the iridescence of like the inner layers of the ear and everything. Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's just, I don't like it.
Yeah. Internal body parts that should not be visible from the outside. But yeah, so they work out that, you know, because it freaks out to the sound, it opens its head and then it's vulnerable and they can just shoot it like anything else. So yeah, and what I like about that is it's like two sides of the same coin where it's like, oh, penny drop moment, we've just figured out how we can kill them now, but we've also just fired a gun in a rural area and now you see on the like footage that they're attracting many others.
Yep.
And in comes part two.
Mm-hmm. Which takes place directly afterwards, right?
Apart from the day one kind of flashback. Obviously. Yeah, it's essentially immediately from that scene, which I do like.
Mm-hmm.
But I said at the start of this episode, it's very similar to Signs and It, like, A Quiet Place is definitely still in my top five. Signs may have dropped down to top 10.
Oh, you've made me so happy.
which may shock the listeners and myself. Signs may have dropped back to top 10 purely because they're so similar, and I will admit A Quiet Place is the better made movie.
It just
movie.
Does it better, yeah.
Yeah, it does it better with similar concept, but I love Shyamalan's style too much to completely eliminate him from my top 10.
Fair enough.
And I think...
Keep at it another year, it'll drop out of the top 10.
Yeah, and I mean, the reason I like horror films like this, where it sort of revolves around a family and them resolving their struggles in this kind of...
because you come from a broken family with a lot of struggles?
No. In this dystopian world, is like the intimacy of having a family as the main characters makes the deaths more meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, there's no disposable characters.
It's a pretty easy way to make the audience care.
Yeah.
Instead of having to go through the work of making them really likable, it's just show them caring about each other and yeah. the audience will care as well.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
pretty easy.
And I just think that's why this is such, like, an effective,
mm-hmm.
In both senses of the word, film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I also do like that the daughter's vulnerability kind of becomes her advantage. It's a nice yeah. kind of character arc for her.
Message that, like, you might be, I don't know, quote unquote disabled, but you can, you know, still use it to your advantage, or you can still do what you want, be a hero. I don't know.
Yeah. And you kind of mentioned this before when I was talking about, like, the guilt and everything, but every character has their own personal laments as well. So they're all, it's essentially a film about hope, right? And they all kind of have their personal grievances. Like, the daughter will never be able to hear. Like everyone else, the son will never be able to do teenager things like learning to drive because it makes too much noise. The mother still listens to like music on an iPod or an MP3 player. Like, you're never going to see live music again.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to be able to just play a record. The father is always like scanning radio frequencies because he's mourning like the loss of contact with other people. And I guess the most overt one is they've all lost a child or a sibling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's like so much centered on grief, which as we've established on this pod is like seems to be a common theme in modern horror films.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, yeah, it gives a certain depth to these characters when they're already more kind of likable, the fact that they're a family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
That is my point.
I have nothing to add to that point as well. Very well spoken.
Oh, thank you. But should we get into like the technique of this film?
Go for it.
You were kind of saying it's not really an arty film. Like, there's not a lot of shots in it that are... Well, you said there's no shot, right?
I'll spoil it now. There's no framed shot in this movie. It's a good looking movie. It's got good cinematography and good framing. But there's no one shot that to me looked like a painting.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not a lot of static shots. Like, there's a lot of movement.
Mm.
One shot I think would be really cool. It'd be hard to pick it for a frame because it's a moving shot, but when Emily Blunt's character is giving birth in the bathtub and it just kind of like tilts
tracks up.
Yeah, it's like the blood pooling in the drain hole. Mm-hmm. I thought that was sick.
Yeah, I mean, I was literally sick.
Sickening. And I guess most importantly is this film kind of reiterates how powerful silence is as a tool to create suspense. Which I love in films like Alien and The Exorcist and Signs. And like something that we've mentioned in a recent episode, I believe, is when you have such a tense moment and a scene is naturally quiet, the audience kind of holds their breath as well. So it kind of works on a physical level.
Yeah.
And I said before, I like when they kind of drop out the audio from the daughter's perspective, even when she like removes the cochlear implant and it's just silence. And it works really well when they're like crossing that bridge and the family's like walking in single file. The parents like turn around freaking out and she's like, what?
Yeah.
She has no idea the kid
completely
behind
oblivious
her.
To like the problem that's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And it kind of happens again in the cornfield when the alien is like creeping out from behind the stalks and she doesn't know it's right there.
Yeah. And that probably saved her as well, because like what happens just before then with the little boy is he thinks he hears something, so he kind of freaks out and takes off running through a very loud cornfield. Whereas she doesn't hear anything, doesn't freak out, and so she's just silent, and so all the creature's not gonna know where she is.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's what I mean, like what makes her susceptible to these creatures becomes her strength.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's very well done. And I said before about like a lot of use of red in this film. red naturally is like symbolic of both like love and danger. And in this film particularly, you've got things like the red light bulbs, which are like a warning sign. You've got the blood. You've got the shotgun shells, the fireworks. Like there was so much red that was sort of signifying a problem or a hazard. But then like all the characters at some point had like an item of red clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Most notably, I guess, with the father and his red sweater. And he was like the warmth and the...
Oh, yeah.
The kind
so
of...
So you're saying... He was dead the whole time.
I just thought that was really, really nice. Because like red is such like an arresting, bold color.
Mm-hmm.
And they've used it on both ends of the spectrum in this film, which is really cool. And like I said before, a lot of like lingering close-ups as like omens that would, you know, foreshadow something to come. And yeah, so in terms of like techniques, like you said, there's not a lot of like... shots where you see it and you're like, oh, I really love how that's framed. It's mm-hmm. just more so like shots that create meaning.
Yeah.
Meaning.
And it does rely a lot on the sound design.
Mm.
Like, I wouldn't frame anything, but I'd surely have some sounds on a loop, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I can't say I've watched a film before and been scared to like squeak in my chair or open a packet of chips like this one.
Yeah.
I might have even seen this twice in the movies, ooh. But I remember like, you know, people that were eating and talking like they would, you could hear a pin drop
yep.
in like some of these scenes, which is sick.
Knowing me, I'd be in the one session with like some asshole that's laughing and talking and shit because I hate that. I hate that so much.
I hate when you sit next to someone and they smell really bad or they're eating something that smells really bad. Like I had one dude that I had to sit through like a 2-hour film. Can't remember what it was. It might have been one of the fucking Avengers films. And he smelled like salami. And I was like holding my breath the entire time, so like breathing into my
salami
shirt.
And cheese sandwich.
Yeah. Like, Jesus, why can't you just have butter popcorn like everyone else?
Because popcorn's gross.
I like the taste of popcorn. I just hate that the shells of the kernels get like stuck between my teeth. So whenever I go to a movie at the cinema, I generally just get like pods.
I don't buy cinema food because I'm not fucking rich.
Oh, you don't like being charged $10 for a bottle of water?
No, I'm afraid I do not. I buy it from Coles and sneak it in like any sane man.
Yeah, I've had like Subway and stuff brought in. Oh man, so
Uber Eats deliver to inside the cinema.
Bit of an abstract question in the Deadheads group this week.
Mm-hmm.
I messaged you Wednesday morning. I was like, what the fuck do I post in here that's gonna relate to A Quiet Place without giving it away? And we came up with, what's your most and least favorite sound?
Yeah, I thought that was quite interesting. I'm actually intrigued to find out because I don't read the answer to the question.
Yeah.
During the week, I just want to hear it in the moment.
It was a bit of a quirky one, and mm-hmm. We got a range of answers. We had Michael, good old MDV, one of our day ones, mm-hmm. said, the sound of someone talking on speakerphone in public. Just hold it to your ear, you donkey. I agree. That's one of my pet peeves. I get it a lot in like shopping centers where there's like music playing, the bustle of people talking all around you, and they're like yelling into their speakerphone that they can't hear the person on the other line.
Mm-hmm.
Like, bro, put it to your ear. Same as public transport. Anyway. And my man Carrie said, he had a number of answers, by the way. Least
well,
favorite?
Too many. We only asked for one of each.
Least favorite was the PDA online sound when the volume's turned all the way up. When you get an online order come through and it scares the shit out of you. Number two was fingernails on a blackboard. That's a common one.
I'm fine with that. That doesn't bother me. It's cutlery on a plate.
Dude, I was going to say
that.
That
is my version of that.
Yeah, I agree. And another one was a new order siren at McDonald's. I think he used to work there. It gives him NAMM flashbacks, I think.
Yeah. Well, Alex used to work at a very famous pizza joint.
Mm.
And she was saying the Uber Eats noise.
Yeah.
Or the, not Uber Eats, what is it? And menu log. Like, yeah, just the noise where it's just constantly like, da-da-da.
Seeps
like,
into your dreams.
Yeah.
He had a bunch for favorite as well, because Carrie's a bit of an audiophile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He had lush reverb.
Okay.
A nice string section. I agree.
Okay.
A Fender Strat on the neck pickup.
That means nothing to me.
Get very specific now. He is a musician as well. A high arcing basketball shot that catches almost all net with just a bit of back rim.
I'll be honest, that was one of my top contenders.
That is satisfying.
The swish sound.
Yeah. And lastly, assorted car engine noises, a flat 6 or 8 cylinder variety.
Nice. See, it's throaty. That's when you want it.
What about you? You got a favorite and least favorite sound?
Well, in a similar vein to they were saying, one of my least favorite, not anymore because I've moved on, but back when I worked at a very famous fast food joint, the sound of the fryers when they're done, the constant beeping.
Yeah, that's right.
I had some dreams that woke me up with that. Some nightmares.
I can empathize with you because I also work for said fast food restaurant that we will never name.
Yeah, I don't know why we don't name it. We're not going to get sued.
We got to slip up one day and have a defamation case against us.
Sued for libel. It's only libel if it's not true or... Right?
What about favorite?
I think my actual least favorite is probably like a very harsh baby crying.
Oh, yeah.
Because when it hits a certain note, your fucking teeth rattle and I hate it. And most, like, the favorite, I don't know. I want to say, like, a crisp, like, can of beer being opened.
Just like Yeah, something that like is, that. I'm not a beer drinker, but that is satisfying.
Yeah, something like that. Or maybe, hold on, let me see if I can pull it up. Maybe this one. Hold on.
Mine Death Whistle?
No, well, you ruined the joke. Yeah, it was going to be Mine Death Whistle, which is not a good sound at all. What's yours? What are your favorite and least favorite?
My favorite, it's probably a basic common one, would be ocean waves.
Okay.
I do like the soothing sounds of reading by an ocean. Puts you to sleep.
Or just like rain on a tin roof, maybe?
That's another good one, but I don't like how it fluctuates.
Okay.
It'll go from like bucketing down to a drizzle and it just the soothing constant waves are nice. Least favorite, one that has gotten me for a long time, is hearing a phlegmy cough.
Okay.
Like when you hear the death rattle in someone around you and you can just hear lumps of shit coming back up.
Mine's the opposite. I like that.
Oh, what?
Not on other people specifically, but on myself because it's like that's an effective cough. The one I hate is when someone coughs but nothing comes up. And it's like,
just
why,
dry.
Why are you coughing? Like there's nothing there.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Now, for me, it's like when I'm fit and healthy and I can hear someone's got some flu-y shit they're trying to get rid of and sounds like they're expelling demons.
Fair.
Not a fan.
That's fine. Of course, I don't know if I have tinnitus, but I think I've got a touch of it.
I think like, everyone does, man.
Because I was thinking about like what my life would be like in this movie and part of me would love it. Like no conversations with people. Sign me up. I love silence.
Yeah.
I love comfortable silences with people.
Yeah.
But having silence around me all the time would literally drive me mad. Like silence is deafening.
Yeah.
In the words of Hands Like Houses.
Yeah.
Silence is deafening and I hate it. If I'm laying in bed at night, I need background noise.
I get it when I'm trying to sleep. And also sometimes if I'm out like at a restaurant or something and there's a lot of conversation around me and only like one ear will just kind of like get the...
Yep.
Like fade out again. I'm like, oh man,
nice.
But yeah, anyway, speaking of sounds, someone's fucking angle grinding next door or something. We've avoided the mower man, but now they're in their workshop. Yeah,
my least favorite noise, the mower man.
Yes,
we're trying to record a fucking podcast.
That's the pod's least favorite noise.
Yes. But yeah, I think that's probably all we have to say about this movie today.
Quiet Place, still in my top five.
Yeah, this will be the first time recording since we moved the episodes to a Monday, right? You think the Suspiria one dropped.
Suspiria.
We made the decision, I think, during recording. I don't know.
I think I messaged you during the week and I was like, man, I've realized whenever I talk to listeners, they say they play us at work or on the way to work. So it just made sense to have it drop midnight Sunday. So whenever you wake up, we're waiting for you.
Yeah. So enjoy your drive to work, which might be like an hour long according to this time. The drive to and from work on a Monday.
If you take a train to work, we will entertain you.
Yeah, but we drop a new episode every Monday at any streaming service, really, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to catch us up in the meantime, you can find us on Deadhouse or Deadhouse Pod.
Mm-hmm.
We have an email at deadhousepod@hotmail.com. The question is asked in Deadheads every week.
Yep.
So feel free to answer that with some good ones we can read out on the podcast. And yeah, we'll be right back.